I'm Jim Benson, and you're listening to TV Time Machine on Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and visit our show archives at tvtimemachine.com.
Memories press between the pages of my mind. Memories sweeten through the ages just like wine.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to embark on a journey through a vast galaxy that traverses memory, generations, and popular culture. A magical trip through time as we meet the men and women of yesterday and today who have shaped not only what we see on TV, but the way we see ourselves. I'm Jim Benson. Join me, if you will, on an exploration of television's past, present, and future as we climb aboard the TV Time Machine. Our destination subject today will be the classic TV series Taxi and the extraordinary life and career of actress Mary Lou Henner. Ms. Henner herself will join us to talk about her new book, Total Memory Makeover, while taking this particular journey exploring the human mind and unforgettable TV memories. We'll begin our exciting and fun-filled odyssey right after these brief messages.
I was born Mary Tyler Moore.
Is Jesse Donald Knotts?
Fred McFeely Rogers.
Leslie Moonves.
Isabel Sanford.
Leslie Renee Stahl.
Robert Edward Turner.
Regis Francis Philbin.
Aaron Spelling.
Since 1999, the Archive of American Television has been preserving the memories, knowledge, and insights of the men and women whose talents and vision have helped shape this remarkable medium. Over 500 video interviews with these TV legends are now available on the Archive of American Television website at metvlegends.org. There, you can sign up to receive news, updates, and also become a sponsor to help preserve television history for generations to come. That's metvlegends.org.
The mythological proportions of Star Trek provide something that's missing in people's consciousness, psyche.
The Archive of American Television, capturing television history, one voice at a time. Today on the TV Time Machine, we take a drive down memory lane to experience history well beyond the scope of the small screen. In this very special edition of our program, we are proud to welcome an extraordinary woman, actress, teacher, and New York Times best-selling author, Mary Lou Henner, best known for playing cab driver Elaine Nardo on the classic comedy TV series Taxi. Ms. Henner's television career also spans a remarkable spectrum, including the comedy Evening Shade, reality series Celebrity Apprentice, her own talk show Mary Lou, and consultant on the TV drama Unforgettable. Over the next few segments, the amazing Mary Lou Henner will help us relive virtually every aspect of this classic television series and her television career, quite literally, as Ms. Henner has the ability to recall her life in remarkable detail, which has inspired her new book, Total Memory Makeover, written with Lauren Henner. Again, for those of you intrepid enough to remember everything about your life, feel free to send us a forget-me-not as we slip from the restraints of the present to experience a most unforgettable past. Mary Lou, thank you for coming on board the TV Time Machine.
Thank you. That was such a funny introduction. Well, thank you. I was thinking when you started playing the Taxi theme about the first time I ever heard it, and it was actually... It was July the 20th of 1978. It was a Thursday. And we had a show that was called Blind Date that we were shooting that week. It was our second episode. And the producers heard it, the song, and it was the name of the song is actually called Angela's Theme.
That's right.
And the character of Angela was this blind date that Alex went on, and Angela was the kind of, you know, when people had phone services, she was kind of the phone service girl
right.
for Bobby. And he meets her. They have a great chemistry on the phone, and then all of a sudden he takes her on this date, and she's like mean and surly and overweight and crabby
right.
and everything else. So she was the star that week, and it was called Blind Date, the episode. And they brought this piece of music in because that was going to be Angela's theme song for the week. And they were still kind of putting all of the bells and whistles on what our first episode was going to be because the show didn't premiere till September 12th that year. And they heard it, and they went, why is this Angela's theme? This should be the taxi theme. So that's why it's called Angela's theme, though.
It really is perfect. And it's a I think it's a five-minute piece of music. And they use
it's incredible.
It
I mean, if you ever really get to hear it on all the jazz stations and everything, you know, and it was so different for that time because everything else was, you know, come and knock on my door and
right.
stuff like that. And Flamel, you know, it was like, we're going to make it. You know, everybody had different theme songs that were much more upbeat and wild and pop music-y and, you know, cartoony in some instances. And here you saw this. You know, and everybody's opening credits had either a montage of what the show was like, but for Taxi, it was just that cab driving over the Brooklyn Bridge and over and over again. And it was actually Tony Danza was driving because they shot some promos with him, and he was the one, he's the driver in the Taxi.
You're kidding.
No.
Really?
No. Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that because usually they just have just some regular Joe doing that.
Right.
That's great.
Right, but he actually drove part of it anyway, yeah.
Well, that was Bob James, right, who did?
Mm-hmm. Bob James.
Right.
Who wrote the Taxi theme. And it's just a great piece of music. It's just a great jazz piece of music. And I think it keeps the show from looking too dated as a result,
right.
You know, because it does, I mean, jazz is so universal and so, you know, timeless that song just has that quality to it. You know, and kind of like the dreamer, you know, going over the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, just over and over again. It's like there's just something about it. It's kind of like that lonely cab driver feeling.
Exactly.
As well. And it's just a really cool theme.
Now, you grew up in Chicago.
I did. I grew up right in the heart of Logan Square, right on Logan Boulevard, if anybody knows Chicago. And I always say that the Kennedy Expressway just missed demolishing my house. I mean, we were so close to the freeway, the expressway it's called, so close that we could see every car that drove by. We were right there, and we were one of the last houses before it was just, you know, before the Kennedy Expressway just, you know, went right there. I mean, it was literally right there. My family, we were the social center of the neighborhood. We were kind of the Kennedys of Logan Square, and everybody with six brothers. There were six kids in my family, but my mother wanted to be a dancing teacher, so my father had a three-car garage built in our backyard. But it was totally fake. It had a fake door on it. It didn't have anything that even remotely resembled a garage, and it was a three-car garage that was really turned into a dancing studio for her. So we had a dancing studio in our backyard, and we had about, this is my kind of like what I say about it, we had 200 students between the ages of 2 and 80, including the nuns from the Catholic grammar school right next door, St.
Wow.
John Berkman's. The nuns came over for stretch classes. So, and my mom would go to the convent as well and teach them, you know, get them stretching and everything. But that wasn't enough for my mother because she also ran a beauty shop out of our kitchen. And my mom was always cutting, coloring, or perming somebody's hair in the kitchen. And then upstairs from us lived my mother's younger brother, who was called Uncle by everyone. And he taught art at the Catholic grammar school next door. And he lived upstairs with 10 cats, 2 dogs, 2 birds, a skunk, 150 fish, and his boyfriend Charles. And Uncle taught art at the Catholic grammar school next door. He had art classes going on upstairs, and he also ran a cat hospital on our roof because he was very good with animals, and he would nurse these animals back to health if somebody in the neighborhood, if their cat got sick.
You know what this reminds me of?
A sitcom?
No, it reminds me of the movie and play, You Can't Take It With You.
Oh, yeah, totally. Everybody always said that.
Yeah.
That, you know, you can't take it with you. We had a real you can't take it with you upbringing. We really did. There was so much activity at my house. I don't think, you know, the 8 people or 10 people with Uncle and Charles upstairs, the 10 people who lived there most of the time, I don't think it was ever just the 10 of us because we always had friends sleeping over. You were always stepping over bodies. Somebody was always at dinner. You know, I mean, my family was really the social center of the neighborhood, and people still talk about that. You know, like I had the parents that everybody wished they had had because they were just, I mean, my parents were just remarkable people, and it makes me so sad to think that they, you know, they passed away so young. My father died when I was 17, and my mother died when I had just turned 26. And they both had terrible deaths. Really, my father had a heart attack. My mother died of arthritis at 58. He was 52 when he had his heart attack. And they were cheated out of so much of life. But the legacy they left and the things that people still say about them, you know that they're kind of their spirit, both of them, their spirits really lived on. So the world that they created in Logan Square and this little oasis of culture and Broadway and film and, you know, everything else, this dancing school and this beauty salon and the art classes, what they created is a much bigger leap than my going from the way I grew up to being in Hollywood. You know, they were just remarkable people. So,
was there a specific catalyst for you that made you decide to pursue an acting career, or was that something that just happened gradually over time and you evolved into it?
Well, what happened was a lot of times people needed kids for shows because, and they'd call our dancing school. So they'd say, oh, we need 12 kids for The King and I. And I was, pick me, you know, or two kids for South Pacific. Oh, pick me, things like that. So I grew up doing a lot of shows. And I felt like I was just on that path to do one show after the next. And then when I was a sophomore in high school, I started working at Hull House. I did a show at Hull House called The Boyfriend, which was critically acclaimed, and it was most all these college people and all of these people outside of the business, outside of school, and certainly people who had other jobs. And somebody that I got to know really well was one of the guys who's 10 years older than I. He still is around, so he's 10 years older than I am. And he called me one day. He said, hey, Henner, I've written this show. It may never get off the ground. I wrote it about the kids I went to high school with. You always reminded me of one of the girls. We're going to perform it in a converted trolley barn, and it's called Grease. And so that was it. I got involved with Jim Jacobs, my friend, and we all got together to work on this show, and the script of it was just this huge deck. You can't see my hands, but, you know, I've got like, it was about 6 inches tall, you know, the stack of scenes. So we all sat around and, you know, let's read the book report scene, and here's the polio shot scene, and here's the air raid shelter scene, and here's the lunch scene, and here's the pitching penny scene, and things like that. And over time, this became Grease.
Wow.
You know, the script for Grease. So we performed it at the Kingston Mines. I was in the original company. I was the first Marty ever,
right,
if you know the play. And I sang Freddie My Love. That was my song. And you know, so I had just gotten 4 scholarships to go to the University of Chicago because I figured I'm either going to stay and go to the best academic school in the city or I'm going to go to New York. So my father had just passed away, and I graduated from high school. Got the 4 scholarships, went to the University of Chicago, and I was performing Grease on the weekends. And you know, then the show went to Broadway. A few of us were asked to come and audition for it, and I said no, because I'm going to stay in school. Plus, we were still kind of re-identifying ourselves as a family. And then in November 27th of 1972, it was a Monday, I get this call from Jim. I'm in my third year of college at U of C, and I get this call from Jim, and he said, Henner, you better come to New York. I saved the part for you. First National Company rehearsals start tomorrow, so, you know, I want you to play Marty. And I said, oh, Jim, I'm on my way to the library. I have 2 papers due. I'm in a show. I have a boyfriend. I can't leave school. So I'm walking to the library with my little books in arms, and I notice my car is parked in front of the library. And I thought, oh, that's unusual. That's right. It's parked there, huh? So I look at the library, look at my car, look at the library, look at my car, looked at the library, threw my books in the car, went to O'Hare, got on student standby, went to New York and auditioned and got the part for the First National Company of Grease.
So that was it. So
that was it.
That was
so
the
I was
moment.
Literally a college student in the morning and a professional actress in the afternoon.
That's amazing. So that's the moment that changed your life and changed the course of everything.
That's what changed my career. But wow. It was really, you know, it was because of my contacts in Chicago. And I always knew I wanted to be an actress and an author. I always knew, even as a little kid, I wanted to act and I wanted to write. So those were always, and I wanted to be the mother of two boys. Isn't that funny?
Wow.
People at 14, people would say to me, do you want to get married and have kids? I'd say, oh, yeah, I'm going to. I'm going to have two boys. I just always saw my two boys somewhere in my future.
That's pretty rare. That's pretty rare, actually, that you can kind of map out your life and those dreams that you had come true.
Well, I think if you start to see your life through, you know, any kind of prism or filter or goal, you know, I think a problem today with so many people is that they're so afraid to pick a goal, or they're so afraid to identify something that they want. And it's like, no, I just want to, you know, meander around, especially mm-hmm. kids. I see it all the time, you know. I'll figure out what I want to do later. At least head towards something. You know, you can always change your mind. I mean, the key to your life is how well you deal with plan B anyway. You can always change your mind, but at least aspire, you know, want something. Want something. I think people have lost their want. And I'm seeing that a lot of kids especially just wander around, just not heading toward anything.
Well, I think if you have goals, I think a lot of people are afraid that if they have goals and they don't reach those goals or fulfill them, then they've failed.
Mm-hmm.
People don't want to fail.
They don't see their life as a big laboratory where even the failures are just part of the experiment.
Right.
I mean, if you're, you know, I mean, I think people get so fixed. This is why I wrote the book, I Refuse to Raise a Brat.
Right.
Because I think that so many people, you know, set up these ridiculous goals that you know, it's like people would rather, they stay at zero on the number line because they're so afraid of failure that they don't move in either direction. You know,
right.
They're so they it's like, oh, I'll keep quiet and they'll let me live. I'll just sit here at zero.
Exactly.
I might end up at -2. Well, sometimes -2 propels you to swing in the other direction and make +10. You know, so whatever. I've always been somebody, and I think I got this from my parents, that it's like, you know, there's a process, and the failures are part of that process too. You know, I teach classes online at MaryLou.com, and I have since 2000. And one of the things we're always saying is progress, not perfection. You know, but if you don't, you know, people go, oh, I blew my diet last night. Or I said, no, you're just in this laboratory called life, and this was your experiment. The experiment didn't do well. Okay, so you have that data. Now let's move to the next thing, you know. So it's a process. I mean, otherwise you're the kind of person who is so afraid to make a move that you do nothing, or you're so afraid of failure that you become paralyzed as a result of, like, a hard knock. But see, I think the biggest problem, and this is why I brought up the Brat book, is that people lack such frustration tolerance, or they lack coping skills for any kind of setback.
True.
And I think that, you know, that's what we have to give our kids more than anything else, this kind of resilience, so that they can say, okay, I failed, I fell, I did this, it didn't go as well, but I'm going to pick myself up again.
Well, in acting, there's obviously a lot of failure. You can certainly fail when you go out for auditions, but in the late 70s, you had a fair amount of acting gigs, now not the least of which can be heard in the following clip.
I love saving in the springtime, Samsonite saving time, I mean. I love saving on these cases to go places, I'm buying everything I've seen. Savings will be dear. Samsonite saving time is here.
Now.
Yes, I was a girl. I did a lot of commercials. I was also a body parts model because I did, you know, four tip Playtex bras and two Playtex panties. You know, if I was on Broadway doing Grease at the time, and I had already done another Broadway show over here. And actually, when I got the Samsonite commercial, I had just done Pal Joey as well. I mean, the Samsonite commercial started running in May 15th, 1977. May 15th, 1977, which was a Sunday. It was in the Sunday supplement of the New York Times and stuff. So it was like a big campaign that they were doing. We actually shot it in December. But so, I mean, you know, I was a young girl on Broadway doing my thing, and then I got cast in Blood Brothers, which I had a screen test for Blood Brothers, so that's what brought me out to Los Angeles. And I left to do that in April. And I had just gotten the job when the Samsonite luggage commercial went on.
I think it was just a couple years later that you were cast as Elaine Nardo on Taxi, which we'll hear in this clip.
Excuse me? My name is Elaine Nardo. They told me to ask for Louis.
Yes, ma'am. I'm Louis De Palma.
Oh, hi.
I hope there's no trouble. If there is, I'll be glad to help in any way I can.
Oh, no, no. It's just that they told me I'd be starting work today as a driver. Oh, here's my hack license.
You're a cab driver? What do you mean, busting my chops here? Make them believe you're a regular person. Go wait over there. I'll call your name and number. Till then, keep your mouth shut.
What's wrong? Don't they feed you in there?
What was it like filming that first episode?
Well, I was very excited. Well, first of all, I was the only girl, so that was a lot of fun, of course, meeting all the guys and stuff. And I had just seen Judd Hirsch in Chapter 2, so I knew his work. I thought he was brilliant. Andy Kaufman I had actually seen a few years earlier at the Improv in New York when I was living in New York doing Broadway. I couldn't believe him because we walked into this place. There was this little foreign man reading from The Great Gatsby and then kept reading and reading and reading from The Great Gatsby, and pretty soon people are throwing dinner rolls and straws at him and things like that. He breaks down crying. There's a hush in the audience. Nobody could believe this little guy who was crying on stage, and you felt so bad. And he turns up stage and then whips off from the side of his pants two pieces of black tape, reveals like studs, and turns around and does the craziest Elvis you've ever seen in your life.
Right.
So I knew Andy Kaufman's work. I was a huge fan of his. And Danny DeVito I knew from Cuckoo's Nest. So
right.
Meeting him, and then, you know, Tony's just hot stuff, so he was, you know, I was a fan from the moment I looked at him.
Right.
And so, you know, here I am with these guys, and they were just unbelievable. So I was very excited to be working with them. And, you know, my mom had just passed away, and I felt like she had gotten the job for me, that she died on May the 13th of 1978, Saturday night, the night before Mother's Day. And I found out that I had definitely gotten taxi on June 4th. So it was really, you know, which was a Sunday night. And I found out, and I always felt like she was the one who made it happen.
Did the cast of Taxi, did everybody click at the outset, and did you know instinctively that you were involved in something special?
Well, first of all, I knew Jeff Conaway, too, because he had been in the National Company of Grease with me.
Right.
So we were like old buddies from the Grease days. And everybody clicked, like, right away. I mean, Andy was always kind of an odd person anyway, so I don't even know if he clicked in his own mind with anything, except he was a song and dance guy, so we really always met on that level. He and I were always like singing and dancing and stuff together because he really wanted to be a Broadway person. But yeah, we knew something was special, but also we came from such a pedigree. We weren't doing a pilot. We knew we had a 12 commitment, you know, a 13 episode commitment, and our producers had just come from the Mary Tyler Moore and the Phyllis and, you know, Rhoda and everything else. So they were very, you know, we knew we were with great guys. And they had written so much for women that they wanted to do a very male-oriented show and have one woman on it. And I was just lucky enough to be that girl.
Well, Mary Lou, we're going to have to take a little break from our fascinating journey, but never fear. I'll be back in a lightning flash with actress Mary Lou Henner, author of Total Memory Makeover, who is riding along with us on the TV Time Machine.